come to order. It's 3:20 on February 15th. With us are Representative Book, Representative Chenault, Representative T. Wilson, and Representative Holmes. We have a quorum. Expect a couple other people shortly, but please turn off your BlackBerries and cell phones. We've got way too many donuts already this year and bagels, but...
I hadn't seen one, Mr. Chairman.
Here's off, Bob. First item on today's agenda will be House Bill 315, Public Accounting. Jennifer from Sinet from my office will be presenting it along with a couple other people. Welcome.
Good afternoon. Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman, members of committee. For the record, my name is Jennifer Sinet, staff to the chair, Rep. Olson. Before you today, you have House Bill 315. It's an act relating to public accounting and providing for an effective date. HB 315 was crafted with the help of the State Board of Public Accountancy and the Alaska Society of Certified Public Accountants, and I'm proud to say that this bill enjoys their support. This legislation is actually very widely supported, and I don't know of any opposition to the bill. Indeed, 45 states have already passed some version of this legislation, and this is merely an attempt to get Alaska up into line with the rest of the nation, and really to keep Alaskan CPAs and Alaskan accounting firms competitive nationally. So turning to the bill itself, it does basically three things. The first thing it does is it gives CPAs mobility. Mobility is the ability of a licensee to gain practice privilege outside of his principal place of business without forms and filings and fees. So in this context, it means that CPAs, it would allow licensed CPAs and CPA firms in Alaska to practice across state jurisdictions with greater ease. And really, that's, again, it's a key to keeping Alaska CPAs and accounting firms nationally competitive. The second thing this bill does is it provides for simple majority ownership. Under current Alaska laws, an Alaskan accounting firm has to be owned 100% by CPAs. And while that might have been adequate in the past, the fact is that the accounting profession has evolved over the years to the point where now it's not only accountants who are working for accounting firms. You have lawyers, you have IT professionals. And so these various non-CPA professionals, they are prohibited under current Alaska law from having any ownership in CPA firms. And so HB 315, what it does is basically it dials down these stringent requirements to provide for only a simple majority ownership. And really, this is a tool aimed at attracting and retaining talent, because right now, non-CPA professionals, there's no hope for them to ever gain partnership in a accounting firm. And so obviously, Alaskan firms have a tougher time hiring and retaining individuals if there's not that carrot of eventual ownership. And so that is the second thing that HB 315 seeks to accomplish. The third thing it does is it enhances the boards of public accountancy's ability to protect the public interest. Under HB 315, the State Board of Public Accountancy will have automatic jurisdiction over any CPAs practicing in the state. So basically, if you're a CPA doing work in Alaska, the Alaska State Board of Public Accountancy will have jurisdiction to address any violations of its standard. So that's basically what HB 315 does. It provides mobility, it allows for simple majority ownership, and it enhances the board's ability to protect the public interest. And as I said before, over 45 states have passed some version of this legislation, and we're just trying to catch up and keep Alaskan CPAs and firms competitive with the rest of the nation. And I'd like to point out that there are representatives from the Alaska Society of CPAs and the Alaska Board of Public Accountancy here, or possibly calling in. And if members have any questions, I think, Mr. Chairman, it might be best to direct the questions to them, as I'm quite sure that they are better versed in the intricacies of accounting than I am. So. With that concludes my testimony on HB 315, and thank you for your consideration.
Well, thank you very much. Any questions for Jim before we bring Max up? Representative Booth?
Mr. Chairman, I have some questions about practice privileges, and maybe the gentleman that was mentioned would be the appropriate.
Yeah, Mr. Mercer. Yeah.
Okay.
Representative Wilson?
Yep.
Oh, thanks again, Jim. Mr. Mertz, will you join us, please?
Mr. Chair, for the record, I'm Max Mertz, 9309 Glacier Highway, Juneau, Alaska, Suite B200. I do have a few remarks. You want me to start with those or go right into questions? I'm Max Mertz. I'm a member of the Alaska Board of Public Accountancy. I've been a member of the board now for 6 years and was its chair for 4 years, ending in 2009. And during my term is when we brought this bill forward. I won't repeat the your staff's comments, but just to say the Alaska Board of Accountancy takes its mission very seriously, that mission being the regulation of the accounting profession in Alaska and protecting the public interest. One of the chief challenges that we've had as a board is carrying out our mission is to be able to effectively pursue licensees from other states who come to Alaska but don't properly serve their clients. Out-of-state practices have become more commonplace, of course, now in the electronic age, too. People can serve clients without ever actually talking to them on the phone. Part of the mobility initiative, which commenced after thorough study by the American Institute of CPAs and National Association of State Boards of Accountancy, each state had its own rules for out-of-state licensees to provide services in other states and for states to carry through and enforce actions of boards of accountancies in other states. This results in an inefficient system that's difficult to navigate. Further, compliance and enforcement is nearly impossible with the multiple cumbersome processes and disparities in requirements in the various states. With mobility, Alaska Board of Accountancy will gain automatic jurisdiction over all CPAs practicing in our state. This will enable Alaska to discipline out-of-state licensees, whether they are registered and licensed in this state or not. The mobility bill can be likened to driver's licenses laws that will provide CPAs with mobility practice in other states rather than their home state while retaining, strengthening our board's ability to protect public interest. And certainly this will only be successful if it's passed by all the states. As it was mentioned earlier, we're down to 5 states. 3 of those have pending legislation, one of which, of course, is Alaska, and the other 2 we're expecting legislation shortly. So we'd encourage the Alaska Board of Public Accountancy unanimously passed resolutions in support of this bill and also the firm ownership bill. And I've done several presentations to state society members and different groups throughout the state over the last year on this bill, and I also know of no opposition to the bill, so I ask for your support. Thank you.
Any questions for Max? Representative Booth?
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. We've been
joined by Representative Lynn. Excuse me.
Thank you. I appreciate your expertise in this rather complex piece of legislation that we have before us here. The main thrust of this is to give reciprocation. Is that what I understand? Is that you're authorizing reciprocation through other states and recognizing their standards as well as it seems to me that we have some published standards in here that are being written into statute. One of them is a term that I wasn't familiar with before, practice
privilege.
Yes, which sounds as though it's a different standard than somebody who actually has a CPA. Would you mind explaining that?
Practice privilege, Representative Book, through the chair, is the ability to, if you're licensed in another state, to come to Alaska to do business, provided that you get a permit to practice in Alaska. So what you're receiving is a permit. It's primarily for firms, but also for individuals. So you're coming here, you're getting licensed, not licensed, but have a privilege to practice in this state. It's primarily for temporary purpose. If you're not, you don't have an office here, you're not providing primary services in Alaska for out-of-state resident CPAs.
If I might. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So this practice of practice privilege, if you will, is something that is standard in other states and is something that is utilized in the industry as a means by which people can become certified or a process by which they're in the process of getting certified, is that correct?
Yeah, through the chair, Representative Book, you're right. It's the best way to think of it is if maybe to give an example, if you are a CPA who lives in another state or a firm who is in another state and you have a client who is doing business here, or potentially have a client that you're doing some temporary work for here, the practice privilege gives you the ability to come up and perform those services. Under mobility, you'll still be able to provide those services without going through the process of actually getting a practice permit. So you will have the ability to come here, provide those services. You're going to subject yourself to the laws of the state of Alaska and also to the jurisdiction by the Alaska Board of Public Accountancy.
So those standards are uniform.
Yes,
those
sir.
Standards are industry-wide, statewide, and this piece of legislation, 315, brings us up to speed in other states.
That's correct, sir.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Representative T. Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I guess I'm trying to figure out, will this give less work to those who live in Alaska if you're going to allow more people to come, you know, and do things there without living here?
What this bill really does is it brings the statute into the 21st century. Those services are already being provided by Alaskan CPAs to out-of-state clients and by out-of-state CPAs to Alaska clients. It's really not going to change necessarily the groundwork for the competitive environment, if you will. What it's going to do is change the licensing environment to bring it up to speed with current practice.
Follow up, sir?
Follow.
So are you saying they're basically breaking the rules now and we're just trying to make them in compliance?
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, to some degree that's accurate. What NASBA and the ICPA found when they were doing these studies over a period of years is that there's actually 54 jurisdictions, the states plus some of the territories, and there are 54 different laws that you had to follow for out-of-state practice. And so it was very confusing and very complex. And what this law does is make those uniform.
Okay. And one more question?
Sure.
Thank you. And there was saying something about the violations. It'll make it easier to be able to take care of those who violate. Who takes care of violations right now?
The Alaska Board takes care of violations now. If we have a licensee, though, from another jurisdiction in the past, and we've had examples where licensee from another jurisdiction who does not have a permit comes to Alaska practices and does some wrong, our ability as Alaska Board to go after that person is difficult. It's very cumbersome. You actually have to get the cooperation of the other state. This will become much easier under mobility for us to enforce action against somebody else from out of state.
Thank you.
Any further questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
I'd like to add that we have Lisa Rogers from the Alaska Society of CPAs online for questions. We also have Julie Olson, no relation, president of the Alaska Society of CPAs for questions also, if anybody at the table has any questions for them. Seeing none, is there anybody in the room that would care to testify on this bill? Is there anybody online that would care to testify? With that, we'll close out public testimony and bring it back to the committee. Representative?
Yes, are you prepared for a motion, Mr. Chair?
Certainly.
Okay. Mr. Chair, I would move HB 315, 26-LS1380/A with a fiscal note. Is there a fiscal note?
Zero fiscal note.
Zero fiscal note and individual recommendations.
Seeing no opposition, the bill will pass out of committee, and I might add that I'm going to meet with the co-chair of finance to see if we can waive it out of finance since it does have a zero fiscal note, and hopefully he'll be agreeable to it. And with that, we'll take a brief at ease to sign the bill. We've been joined by Representative Newman. Item on the agenda is House Bill 280, Natural Gas. We've heard this bill previously, and with us we have the sponsor, Representative Hawker, and two people on his staff and several other people that will be testifying. I don't want to mention Kathy Forster by name, but Representative Hawker.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Pleasure to be here. For your record-keeping purposes, I am Representative Mike Hawker, District 32 in the Anchorage area. Mr. Chair, I guess today what we're here is to first, my brain trust and myself would very much appreciate your contemplation of passing House Bill 280 from this committee. but as we discussed last time we were before you, the RCA had just requested the legislature to make a determination on whether or not they would have regulatory authority over gas storage facilities. And we have before, if it's all right for me to reference it, sir, at the coordination with your staff, and the second thing we had was we said we were going to have a number of, you just call it ministerial, you know, cleanup sort of comments in the language of the bill. And if I'm not getting ahead of myself, what we have before us is an amendment that we would request that you pass that would address these issues.
And that being S.2?
And that would be, yes, S.2 by Bullock, 213.10, I think is the date I've got.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Newman.
I would like to offer amendment / S.2 Bullock from 12-13 for committee discussion.
Is there any opposition?
Approval.
Object for
purposes of discussion.
Purposes of discussion, Mr. Chairman.
And Mr. Chair, if I would, I'll ask the chair or Mr. Pursley to talk about it.
Oh, yeah.
No, that's right.
I figured out a way to speed this up. Yeah.
Mr. Pursley?
We don't need his finance.
Okay. For the
Welcome.
Record, Larry Pursley, staff aide to Representative Hawker. As the representative said, it's a 8-page amendment, most of which deal with cleanup language. The one substantial issue that Representative Hawker is discussing starts on the bottom of page 3, goes to page 4. It's a new section 7, and as the representative explained, in response to the Regulatory Commission of Alaska, which said, we don't know if gas regulation falls under a jurisdiction. It's just not clear in AS 420506. This amends the definition of utilities that are subject to RCA regulation to say that if you're furnishing storage services for natural gas that is owned by a utility regulated by the RCA, that storage service falls under RCA jurisdiction. Pretty simple amendment.
Representative Newman.
Mr. Pursley, was I make sure that with the amendment it allows for the rates to the utilities to fall under RCA jurisdiction?
Correct, Representative Newman. The RCA would treat it like any other utility. The storage operator would have to present its costs, its information, and get its cost of service approved by the RCA.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to make sure we had oversight.
Representative Booth.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the purposes of clarity, all of the gas coming into this facility would be from a utility. Would there be private sector gas, or would there be other that would come under the purview of the RCA that this language would include?
Through the chair, Representative, if the storage operator is providing storage service for gas that's owned by utility, that storage operation is going to be regulated. The fact that they may have other gas owned by someone else, by a speculator, by someone who's marketing gas, by a producer, doesn't matter. If there's any gas in there that's owned by utility, that storage operation will be subject to RCA jurisdiction.
Paul?
Mr. Chairman, I heard an if. I heard an if. You said if gas. Okay. Would there be other gas? Are all of the gas inclusive in this description that we're dealing with in this bill comes under the purview of the RCA? Is there any other considerations here that should be taken into account when we're looking at this re-regulation?
Well, through the chair, Representative, the storage service is subject to regulation, not necessarily the gas.
Okay.
The RCA is not involved in setting the rates for the gas in this amendment. It deals with the storage service. So that's gas that's stored and that the owner is paying for storage services could be owned by utility. It could be owned by, if I wanted to get in the gas marketing business.
Mm-hmm. Just trying to be clear in what we're doing here. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Holmes, followed by my co-chair, vice chair.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I hope I'm not being
repetitive from Representative Book's question. I'm just, it looks like this is amending the definitions section. So basically, it would take any entity that was doing this, namely furnishing injection, storage, and withdrawal services for natural gas, is owned by a utility regulated. I'm trying to get my head around that.
Well,
because it basically seems sort of circular that it defines as a utility anyone who is doing something owned by a utility.
Through the chair, the gas is owned by a utility. The utility is not going to own the storage operation. But, for example, let's say a producer, and there are a couple producers now who have their own storage, they don't make it available for third parties. They operate that storage for their own needs. That would not be subject to regulation. Because the gas that's going into storage is not owned by a utility. It may later be sold to a utility, but this deals with storage operations that provide services to regulated utilities.
So, Mr. Chairman, I'm just trying to wrap my head around this definition. If you had a non-utility that built one of these storage facilities, they could basically store gas there without being regulated, so long as the gas was owned by them?
Correct. If a non-regulated utility, a producer, for example, builds a storage operation and just stores its own gas, does not store gas that's owned by a utility, then that would not be a regulated storage operation.
So, Mr. Chairman, following that up, if, let's just stay with the hypothetical of a producer owning it, injecting gas that it has, its own gas, if it's going to sell that gas to a utility, even if that wouldn't be gas that was currently owned. It would be owned by the producer, not owned by the utility. So even if it was going to be sold to utility, it would not be covered by this definition.
Correct.
Okay. Just right. Trying to get my head around what we're doing.
Right. The intent of this amendment, the intent of this is to regulate storage services that are being purchased, paid for by regulated utility. The gas that eventually, whether it's from this or something else, certainly the gas supply contracts a utility has are going to have to become before the RCA just like they do now.
Okay.
Representative
Newman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, Larry, I make sure that I'm clear, and I did have the opportunity to sit down and spend an hour or so with Larry earlier, so it was pretty informative to me, where we've got native and non-native gases that could possibly be in a gas field, where you've got a storage facility that may be located there. And so as it's metered through, you know, as storage gas, as non-native gas into that reservoir, that gas is when it's come back out, when it comes back out, goes to distribution, that falls under the authority of being regulated gas. Mm-hmm. To make sure that those costs of storage and stuff, you know, are not excessive and not passed down to the customers, the regressive tax is. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Holmes?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And this may be a question for Mr. Pursley, or I don't know if we have the RCA on the line, but I know the question was originally raised to us at the prior hearing about the RCA actually saying, please help. We want to make sure. Has this? I assume that this has been run by the RCA. Have they weighed in and said, yes, this fixes the confusion?
I think I can answer that. Weaverich goes away online later.
Wonderful,
on.
Mr. Chairman. I'll let Mr. Pursley off the hook. And
Commissioner Pickett's in Washington, D.C. and unavailable to participate. Representative Newman, you have one more? Or?
No, I'm good. I think I'm clear on it.
Is there any further opposition to the amendment S2? Seeing none, it's adopted. We also have Amendment S3, which changes one word. Made a shall, I think, isn't it?
Funny man.
S3, Larry, you going to walk us through
Mr. Amendment? Chair, I'd like to offer Amendment Number 3.
Object for discussion.
Which would be version /S/ S.3.
Mr. Chairman, I'm not sure I can.
No, I think right now it's just number 3.
Or number 3. It's the one that look at just for clarity. Yes.
Okay. Operations to operation.
Got it. I do have it, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Chairman, Amendment Number 3 just fixes one of the operations we missed into an operation.
Okay.
for consistency's sake.
Is there any further opposition to amendment number three? Amendment number three passes. With that, I think we'll go to public testimony at this time. Thank you very much, Larry. And in the room, we have Kathy Forrester. She's here.
Mr. Chairman, I'm here to answer questions. I have no testimony.
I think we had a couple of questions from last time, didn't we? I believe you had some questions from last time for Ms. Forrester.
We always love to talk to her.
Come on up, Kathy. Representative Holmes?
Oh, Mr. Chairman, I'm trying to get my on what my their questions are. Oh, if somebody else has questions, they can feel free to jump in while I sort of get my head around my thoughts.
I recall they had at least three members that wanted to see Kathy down here.
While you're formulating questions, I'll sing the University of Texas fight song. Off key.
I found some of the questions. Can the AGOC do what is asked of them if the bill passes?
Yes, we can. And there will be no physical note associated with it.
Do you think this process will work?
As far as the piece that resides in our agency, it'll work. It's very consistent with what we already do.
Yeah, I'm sure you can have an opinion on this, but do you have an opinion as to whether offshore reservoirs can be used for storage in Cook Inlet?
If an operator follows our storage regulations, then it doesn't matter whether it's offshore, onshore, under my house, under a daycare center. That was a little bit extreme.
It's not your daycare center, correct?
But the fact that my children are in their 20s and don't have their own children yet makes that even better. No. What the ALGCC does is ensure that when an operator operates a storage reservoir, that they do it in a way that the gas will stay where it's supposed to stay. And until it's needed to be brought back out. And what that means is that we make the operator ensure mechanical integrity of every well that penetrates the reservoir, and also demonstrate to us that the reservoir itself has integrity to hold the gas. I don't know if any of you are familiar with the story of Hutchison, Kansas. Have any of you heard of that one?
No.
There was a storage reservoir about five miles outside of town, and the gas storage approval process was naive, and that they were unaware of the complex geology until a couple of buildings in the city of Hutchins, Kansas, exploded. since then,
wow,
we have become much more sophisticated, and an operator must prove to us that the reservoir has integrity and acts as a closed system, so that gas can't seep out into places that you're not expecting it to go, and that every well that penetrates that reservoir has mechanical integrity so that it can't become a flume.
Especially if it's under a daycare center, Mr. Chairman.
So if an operator came to us and met all of our requirements for gas storage, it would be as safe onshore as it would offshore. And, you know, as far as which would cost more or be logistically more difficult to deal with, outside of our jurisdiction. Did that answer your question? With a little humor.
Chenault, followed by Representative Newman and Representative Holmes.
Thanks, Mr. Chairman. Kathy, I got probably an odd question.
Oh, good.
And I can certainly see it happening in the Cook Inlet, because there probably are a few places. But when gas is reinjected into the ground, is there any, does ALGCC controller, or who would control, or who would somebody that happens to have mineral rights, private mineral rights, who would they contact? Is there, you know, because I can see it coming. If one of these fields happens to be a field that there's some somebody has mineral rights to, they're going to think that they should get compensated for gas going into the ground and coming back out of the ground. And, you know, that's something that I've kind of wondered about.
The AOGCC, through, I'm sorry, Representative Chenault through the chair, the AOGCC certainly does play a role in protecting correlative rights. So one of the very first things that the operator would have to demonstrate to us in order to get the storage injection order would be that they do have ownership or approval of all owners in the acreage. So yes, is the short answer. That would be us.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Newman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And then just back to an earlier question about where, because it, a permit, an area for exploration is goes through a permit, but oftentimes gas fields overlap in those permits. I mean, there's different permittings in the same gas field. And so if you've got an injection facility for underground storage, you have basically a commingling of a molecule of gas that could be available there. So to make sure that a producer who has the rights to drill for gas, that's, I guess, where AOGCC would ensure that those rights aren't infringed upon, because that meter is, that gas is metered going in. I think you just said that you make sure that those gas fields don't leak migrating molecules of gas, for lack of a better terms. I don't know how you could say it, but that's the intent, I believe, to make sure that people who already have the right to get a certain amount of gas out of that field, that's not infringed upon, I think. Correct?
Representative Newman through the chair, yes, that's correct.
I can see in my mind it's trying to...
Well, I wasn't sure I heard a question, so I hate to say that I agree.
That
yes
sense.
Or
yeah,
no.
I'm good. Thank you.
Representative Holmes.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. You've testified that you guys have no problem complying. You foresee no problems for your agency complying with the terms of this. Are you already doing some of the things in this, or are you already basically signing off on these?
Representative Holmes through the chair. What we already, there goes a kiss. What we already do is, as I say, an operator comes to us and says, I want to inject gas into this reservoir. And what they have to tell us is what maximum pressure they expect to subject the reservoir to. Mm-hmm. And they have to give us a good geologic description of the boundaries and size of the reservoir, and they have to prove to us that every penetration of the reservoir has sufficient mechanical integrity to withstand those pressures. We check off on all of those things. And with all of that data that they've given us, there's one more step that we do just out of curiosity already, and just a little bit of, anal engineering. And that is, given the pressure that they're starting with and the pressure that they say they may go as high as, they want permission to go as high as, with those two pieces of information and a good description of the reservoir or a good production history from the reservoir, if it was a producing reservoir, we can then get a very good estimate of how much gas will go into the reservoir if they store starting at this pressure and taking it up to that pressure. We can get pretty darn close to exactly how much gas that will be, and we already do that. And I think that's everything that would be required of us in this bill.
And a couple of follow-ups, Mr. Chairman. So the requirements that are in here, including the sort of the maximum, the pressures and the, all the technical requirements in here seem to be acceptable.
Yes.
From your standpoint?
Representative Holmes through the chair, we may have to tweak our regulations a little bit to require operators to provide a little bit more information so that we can do everything. But a minor tweak to our regulations, we do that all the time as technology changes and that sort of thing. So,
another follow-up, Mr. Chairman.
Exactly.
After two, I got to ask again. How much capacity in the Cook Inlet, reservoir capacity in the Cook Inlet area do we have right now, either already in use or authorized or sort of pending applications?
We have three areas, Representative Holmes through the chair, I apologize. Engineers like to get right into their numbers. We have three areas of approval. There are five or six storage injection orders approved, but they really encompass three areas. And then there are two more applications for storage injection that have come into us. And I'll take my glasses off so I can read my numbers. The three areas that we have approved storage injection are the Kenai, Sterling area, and that's usually considered to be 6 BCF of storage, but that's simply because that's what the operator says they intend to have as their annual up and down. Mm-hmm. But given the pressure that it started at and the pressure they've asked us for permission to go to, that reservoir, and it's only 100 pounds increment, so it's a tiny increment, that reservoir could store 25 BCF of gas as opposed to the 6 that it says it wants to store. Mm-hmm. And again, that's only with 100 PSI of pressure increase, so that tells you for every 100 PSI of pressure increase, you could get approximately 25 more BCF. But they would reach a point where the wells wouldn't have mechanical integrity, and we would say, no, you can't go above that. But we haven't been asked to do that, and I don't know what that is. So there's 25 BCF in the Kenai Sterling area at Pretty Creek. There are two intervals that, using that same method of determining volume, have a composite 2.5 BCF of storage capacity. And at Swanson River, there are three reservoir intervals that have a composite of 5.3 BCF of storage capacity. Again, these two, also I think the DNR may have them listed as having a lower capacity based simply on what the operator said was his intended storage volume. But for the pressures that they got permission to go to, they have more ability. And we have Aurora has applied for a storage injection order at Nikolai Creek, and that one would generate another 0.8 BCF. And another operator at Ivan River has asked for a pressure increase that would get them in a little over 3 BCF of storage. So to get in total, that's between 36 and 37 BCF of storage capacity that's either already approved or in the process of being approved in the inlet right now.
Mr. Chairman, if I may do one or two more. since we got her here and we brought her all this way, we would hate not to
take advantage of it.
Do you know how much of that is actually being used as storage right now? Is there really any gas being stored in the Cook Inlet area?
Representative Holmes, through the chair, it's my understanding that a small volume is being stored, but it's not near the full capacity.
Okay. And, Mr. Chairman, I'm curious, and she doesn't have to answer this, she doesn't have an answer, but I'm curious as to why, if the capacity is out there and in some cases already been approved, why it's not being stored down there.
Representative Holmes, through the chair, that's probably a question better asked of the operator.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Yeah, I don't see anybody in the room that could probably touch that one. Representative Newman?
I just thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Forrest, I was trying to formulate this question into my mind and I'm trying how to ask it. If we had a development plan that was proposed and that had a lot of pressures in Cook Inlet and oil and gas and liquids and then it was disapproved by the department, stuff like that, how we'd go forward. But I'll just pass on that one.
Representative Booth.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Director, I was wondering, we do have an agent or producer, if you will, that is in the process and has been for a long time storing and shipping LNG. And I don't know if this comes under your purview or not as to quantity. I was just wondering, do we have a relationship here that is quantifiable that gets shipped out every year from the Cook Inlet area?
Representative Book through the chair, our authority pretty much stops at the wellhead.
Okay.
We don't get involved in anything past the valves at the tree.
Okay. Thank you.
I don't know how much it's shipping.
Mm-hmm. You know?
32 bees a year.
30. Through the chair, colleague.
Want to go to the angle?
Yes, if that, if somebody in the room could answer that, I would appreciate that.
32 B.
32 billion cubic feet.
A year.
A year. Are being shipped out as we speak. Okay. I just.
Not for much longer.
Well, till 2011, I understand, has that been approved through. So I just want to put that on the record. Thank you.
Also, Mr. Chairman, if I can, I can't just let that go. I'd also like to put on the record that without having the ability to access that storage facility, as if that's what we want to call it, there may have been times in the recent past where we would not have the gas to run the consumer utilities. So it plays an integral part in the big picture of the overall gas storage and gas distribution system in the Cook Inlet. So while some may think that all we have to do is put that LNG facility out of business and we've got all the gas in the world that we want, that's just not just not a fact.
I think what Representative Schnault was alluding to is, I believe, called peak shaving, when we shorted some of the loads going to Japan to when we had an extremely cold winter, and I think it happened two or three times in the last 2 years.
I couldn't tell you how many times, Mr.
Maybe
Chairman.
Mr. Chairman, if I might, I was just trying to put on the record that we do have a mechanism, and it is integral with those of us as consumers in a utility in Anchorage, whereby there is a storage that's already an integral component, and it needs to be considered as well. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Any further questions for Ms. Forster? Thanks again for coming down.
Thank you.
Is there anybody in the room that would care to testify on this bill? I know we've got several people online, but seeing nobody in the room, Mayor Sullivan, are you with us?
Yes, Mr. Chairman.
Oh, welcome. Please state your name and affiliation for the record, and you've got our undivided attention.
Well, thank you very much. My name is Dan Sullivan, Mayor of Anchorage. I'm here to testify on HB 280, the S version. And first and foremost, I want to wish everyone a happy President's Day, and I know the presidents would be proud of all the hard work you're doing on a vacation day, so it's good to be with you. And just another personal note, if I could, in talking about Cook Inlet, you can't help think about ConocoPhillips, and of course the loss of Jim Bowles is weighing heavily on my mind, and I know everyone else's today, so we send our thoughts and prayers to his family. This bill is important to both Anchorage and South Central Alaska, and we had the opportunity with my energy task force some months ago to meet with Representative Hawker, and he'd indicated his intention to put forth a bill like this that covered really the three main areas that I see as being essential to the long-term energy future of Cook Inlet and certainly to all the communities that surround Cook Inlet in South Central. First and foremost is the ability to create storage. Second is incentives to both maintain and increase production in Cook Inlet. And third is the opportunity for us to clear any regulatory hurdles that may occur as these sort of contracts go in for consideration and keep the consumer in mind when we're considering these things and not particularly just the price. So we're concerned, as you all know, about the declining production of natural gas, particularly as it relates to pressure, which is the key to deliverability, particularly on cold winter days. And as was mentioned, there have been events in the last two of the last 3 years. This winter we've been lucky so far, but two of the three previous years, there were deliverability concerns in the natural gas system. And it's not that there's a shortage of gas. It really is all about the pressure. And this is where storage comes in. It helps us maintain that pressure. So we have taken several steps to help deal with it in the short term, including, obviously, our Energy Watch program, which emphasizes the consumer participating in turning down the heat and turning down the lights so that we can actually conserve natural gas during those very cold days. And so far, our initial results with that have been outstanding, but we can't rely on that really as a long-term solution. And when we talk about Cook Inlet, one of the things to remember is that, I can't remember who it was, but I think it was the head of BP a couple of years ago when they were talking about all the different possibilities out there of gas lines and bullet lines. And his comment was the solution to Cook Inlet is Cook Inlet. And I concur with that. We know that there's at least probably 10 to 15 years of gas supply in Cook Inlet, not counting any new discoveries that are going to be forthcoming, we hope. And so the bill that's been put forth by Representative Hawker and Representative Chenault and the other co-sponsors really does several things which we support. First, the strong requirement that any financial benefits that come from the incentives in the bill flow through to the utilities that contract for gas to the benefit of their consumers, we think is a good feature. The 40% credit for exploration expenses in Cook Inlet against production taxes, which we think is a great incentive to get increased production in Cook Inlet. And again, the directing the Department of Law to consider the impact to consumers in the event that the RCA rejects a utility's gas supply contract. So those three elements are key to the bill. That's why we support it. I won't go into any of the details of incentives or what that creates in terms of, dollars and figures and that sort of stuff. There's people a lot smarter than me that will analyze that and relate what it really means in terms of money. But just generally speaking, we think this bill covers those three key elements that we think are essential. And with that, I'll answer any questions if possible, and thank you for allowing me to be here today.
Any questions for Mayor Sullivan? Thanks again, Mayor.
Hey, my pleasure. Thank you, sir.
We also have online Kevin Banks from the Division of Oil and Gas for questions. We have Mr. Jan Wilson from the RCA, Rich Gasway from the RCA, Stuart Sullivan from the RCA. Any questions for any of those? Kevin Banks, are you with us?
Yes, I am, Mr. Chairman. This is Kevin Banks.
Representative Holmes has a question for you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm not sure that whether this is the right person, but there was I think I had a question to Ms. Forrester about how much of the storage capacity on the in Cook Inlet is actually being used, and it sounded like the answer is not much. And I guess the question was why not, mm-hmm. And I was wondering if maybe Mr. Banks had any insights on why we aren't currently using any of the applied for and possibly available capacity.
Through the chair, Representative Holmes, I think Kathy Forrester's answer to that was probably the right one to get a precise answer. You'll need to ask the operator, but I suspect it has to do with increased capacity even in existing storage costs money, and so there's some balance between say drilling another well or adding more compression that may not be needed unless the owner of the storage today has customers for the gas. If a producer has a market because they've got certain contract supply obligations, why then I suspect they would increase the capacity by spending a little bit of money to do that. I think it's appropriate to think of storage that has been constructed so far in the inlet is in response to the kind of trade-off observed by our producers in meeting their supply obligations, that it might have been considered cheaper to construct storage rather than to drill more production wells because of the risk that the new wells might not be as productive as older wells used to be.
Follow?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Well, where my head's going, I don't have any particular objection to the bill. I'm just doing the same thing everyone's doing, I think, which is trying to figure out, you've got the wells aren't being drilled, you've got the LNG facility currently in place going away, you've got supply contracts, you got RCA, you got this, you got that, you got all the different factors. I'm just trying to figure out, make sure that since we got the bill in front of us, that, and I know there's been a lot of good work put into this, I'm just trying to make sure that we're kind of covering the bases that need to be covered to give ourselves the best shot at actually getting sustainable gas supply out of Cook Inlet. So I'm fishing around just to make sure that.
I might add, we've got three people from the Department of Revenue online too for any tax questions if anybody has any. Thanks again, Kevin.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Anybody have any questions for anybody that's online?
Can we get somebody from the RCA, Mr. Chairman?
Rich Gasway, are you with us?
Yes, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Holmes has at least one question. I'm guessing three.
Well, it may only be one, Mr. Chairman, depending on the answer. I just wanted to kind of dot the I and cross the T. When we put in this amendment, I just wanted to make sure that from the RCA's perspective that the amendment that we passed today addresses the concerns that were coming out of the RCA about jurisdiction. I thought we might as well get that on record.
That'd be S.2, Rich?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, I've seen it. Representative Holmes, through the chairman, we did make a plea for some guidance on jurisdiction over storage, and the intent of the drafters is clear. We did not have a chance to participate in the drafting. So I guess the intent is clear, but the language we could see some improvement to.
Mr. Chairman,
follow up.
Apparently, I did have more than one question, Mr. Chairman. Did you have any proposed language that you thought would be clearer?
We would like our AG to look at it and help us with some of the drafting language. I think the go to the actual language. I think. Let one of my colleagues interrupt me, but I believe part of it that seemed to be a little unclear to us is that could stand improvement, I would say, is the furnishing, injection, storage, and withdrawal service for natural gas that is owned by a utility regulated under this chapter.
Page 4.
I believe the latter clause there is what one concern we could see raising some clarification on as far as the phrasing on that. And I don't have a suggestion on the fly as we speak.
Mr. Chairman, so that's that line 12 for natural gas that's owned by a utility regulated under this chapter. Is that the language, that line 12, page 4 of the amendment?
Rich?
Yes, sir. Yes, Mr. Representative Holmes, through the chair, that is the language we're speaking of.
Okay.
This would be something you could work with at the next committee?
Definitely, sir.
Any further questions for the RCA or?
Unless he's got other comments on the bill in general, that was my main question, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you very much, Rich.
Representative
Newman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And whether Rich or Kevin Banks or one of them, I know I discussed this with the sponsor. If there was an large industrial user of gas situated in the Cook Inlet area, a GTL plant there where they would need
one.
The ability to, you know, have volumes that change, you know, periodically, because you never, these, you know, gas wells, you don't just turn them up or down or off. I would imagine that this would only stand to complement a processing facility like that. Is that correct? To, I guess, Kevin Banks or RCA guys.
Anybody want to touch that one?
Mr. Chairman, I'll take a stab at it. I guess what you are saying, Representative Newman, through the chair, is that...
No, this is Kevin Banks, isn't it?
Yes, it is. I'm sorry. Kevin Banks speaking. That the expectation is that storage somehow is similar to an industrial user who, I take it, would then shut down during peak demand periods and thereby redirect gas into the local market. Physically, that is a correct statement. I think there's not much difference. What is different is that currently their industrial users, such as the LNG plant, does not have a kind of a storage relationship or sales relationship with the local. The local consumers of gas. And so unlike the kind of storage that we're contemplating here, where gas that's coming out of storage is sold to the users, or the consumer, and there presumably is some kind of transparency about the pricing of that kind of service, that similar transparency doesn't necessarily exist, nor is there necessarily a market for gas that is somehow redirected out of the LNG plant by those who are producing gas for the LNG plant. It's just part of their normal supply contract obligations. I don't know, that doesn't probably make it very clear. I'm just saying that the LNG plant does not participate in the local market in the same way that this kind of storage facility would.
So how's this? It's more like a bank. They pull their gas out, their own gas out when they need it, put it back in when they have excess.
That is correct, Mr. Chairman. And also, it is to the extent that the gas is owned by the utility, as your amendment will do, then we have some indication of how the regulation of the price of the storage. In all of the other situations, including LNG and producer-owned storage, where their own gas is stored in the storage, we don't have those kinds of price indicators.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Any further questions? Thanks again for everybody that has been with us online. And with that, is there anybody online that would care to testify that we haven't talked to yet? Seeing none, is there anybody else in the room that would care to add anything or testify? Seeing that, we close it out to public testimony at this point in time. And
if there is no further discussion, I think we all understand the need for storage facilities in Cook Inlet, and I think that we've all discussed that pretty good, and I'd like to make a motion to move the bill, if that's... That's okay.
Attached amendments.
Okay, so Mr. Chair, I'd like to move CS for House Bill number 280, version / S, bullet dated today's date, as amended, with any attached recommendations or fiscal notes from committee.
Any opposition? Seeing no opposition, the bill moves out of committee. Brief at ease.
In the office with him. We went on and on and on, and there were so many little details that were overlooked and then caught, and as they went through, and it doesn't surprise me at all that there's something kind of deep down in it that ended up violating federal law. It just surprises me that it took this long for the federal government to see it.
Well, can we expand the title?
Mr. Chair, I don't know if I should ask for a conflict of interest or not. I have six kids, but one of my daughters has eight children. They're in Indiana, and they do rent.
But not up here.
Not up here.
We can call that one amendment. Representative Booten.
Are they all under 18?
Mine, yes.
Okay.
Well, grandchildren, I mean.
Any further questions? Well, we do have another gentleman from Alaska Housing. And we haven't got Genevieve up here yet.
We need to get Genevieve.
Is there anybody in the room that would care to testify on this bill? Thanks a lot, Representative Blatt. Brian.
Thank you.
Seeing no one in the room, is there anybody on the line? Well, with that, we'll close out public testimony and bring back the committee for discussion.
Mr. Chair,
Newman.
I think this is a bill that just kind of makes sense. It's a good cleanup piece of legislation. I thank Representative Miller for her commitment to making sure Alaska is the best place it can be for all kids, and would like to move this bill from committee.
Seeing no opposition, the bill moves out of committee. And with that, we'll adjourn at 4:35.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to make a motion to move House Bill 238 version as amended or not amended with any possible suggestions and fiscal notes from committee.
Seeing no opposition, we'll move it out of committee and adjourn at 4:35.